Good morning, everybody. We're here with Aaron's Gun Shop High Cap Adventures. We got a great show for you this morning. This is Richard Dodd sitting in for Matt Boutros, who's off doing something very important today. Our show highlights, it's going to be exciting. We have some true stories of self-defense. We have an observation piece. We're going to have attorney Benton Ross Watson here to talk about the Fifth Amendment, the most important amendment of all. So we have some excitement there. We're going to have the tactical snacking with Renee Goodman. Then we're going to have the voice of the lawyers. Benton Ross Watson again and Richard Dodd will be talking about something like guns. We're going to have a devotional minute, a product spotlight, and an interview segment with Sarah Bogan about yoga. And how we're going to connect yoga with yoga, for yoga. So, the highlights involve true stories of self-defense brought to you by the NRA. In this section, I'll read you three stories from the NRA's Armed Citizen pages of the American Rifleman. Hopefully, these true stories, when we listen to them, we will learn what we might do and what we might not do in situations involving true stories of self-defense. It seems that at Prospect, Connecticut, at a car dealership, the owner and an employee were tending to business when two masked invaders burst in through the back door. They were armed with handguns, and they began assaulting the owner and the employee. Luckily, an armed patron, somebody just in shopping for cars, happened to be in the building, and he opened fire on the two attackers. Both men fled through the back door. Police and EMS found one attacker nearby, and he was subsequently declared deceased at the scene. He was a dead man. What do you think, Ross?
Well, I'm just glad that no workers that were getting assaulted got shot. I think it's a good shot if he's able to shoot those guys and right while there was a fracas.
I would say he was half a good shot. The other guy got away, remember? You talk about lucky. The other guy's lucky in that he didn't get shot, number one. But also, guess what? There's no witnesses to
So, yeah, I mean, it was a good. He was at the business.
Nobody knows his name. But we all know the other guy's names. It is permanently inscribed on a stone somewhere in Connecticut. So we got a thief then, a different story, a true story. A thief got more than he bargained for after stealing a sports utility vehicle in Missoula, Montana. Missoula, Montana, that's a neat place. Just after 8 a.m., local deputies were called in to investigate the theft, and in their search for the offender, they spotted the SUV and attempted to pull it over. They apprehended the illicit driver. However, the driver, being pretty smart, fled through several neighborhoods and a construction site before crashing into a mailbox. Pretty smart, huh? Anyway, witnessing the pursuit and crash outside of his window, a nearby resident armed himself in case he was drawn into the confrontation. And guess what? Sure enough.
He was drawn into the confrontation.
He was drawn into it. Anyway, the carjacker chose to force his way into that very house where he was met by the vigilant homeowner and held there until the police arrived to arrest him on multiple charges. Another lucky guy, considering how smart he is, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, he just picked the right house. The wrong house.
Well, I mean, you know, he's not named on that tombstone, at least. So in a way, considering all things, he's pretty lucky. So then in another true story, a Texas couple out doing errands had to fight their way out of the danger after being targeted by criminals looking for someone to rob. The husband and wife duo were followed on their way from the bank to the grocery store, and then, upon loading groceries into the car, a black SUV pulled into an adjacent parking lot. Abruptly, one of the occupants of that SUV jumped out, pulled a gun, and demanded the woman's purse. Fearing for his wife's safety, her husband drew his own firearm and used it to fend off the suspect. The two robbers, both injured, drove off, but proceeded to crash their vehicle before attempting to flee on foot. Police arrested one suspect after he turned up at a nearby fire station seeking help for a shoulder wound. That was in Katy, Texas.
So that's what stands out to me is the fact that this was in Katy. I was actually going to comment before I even saw where this was. I was going to say this happens all the time in Houston. You got to be very careful, especially if you're an elderly couple. People get targeted. Doesn't happen near as much in a smaller community such as Cameron, other places that are smaller communities. But this does happen in places that are even mid-sized. We're talking about College Station, Bryan, Temple, anywhere in the big community. So even though you don't live there, if you're going and you got your purse and you're making yourself vulnerable. So all the stuff for self-defense definitely goes into play with what Matt is trying to teach you, as well as from a legal standpoint, if you've got elderly parents, right, make sure that they're aware that when they go out to these larger cities that people do actually target them. People actually do follow them. They will follow them. This is not some uncommon occurrence. I'm just glad that this happened in their favor. They were trained from somebody like Matt, probably.
Especially when you're coming home from the bank.
Exactly. So
yeah. When they're going to sit out in front of the bank and watch people come in and come out and follow them. So, yeah, be careful. You don't have to be paranoid, but be prepared.
Exactly. That's exactly what Matt would say.
All right. So we're going to be here. Hang on. We'll be right back. All right, respectforyou.com is my website, Richard Dodd. And we got attorney Benton Ross Watson, a Yo-High star academia and football player and college football scholarship recipient and attorney here in Cameron, Benton Ross Watson. How you doing this morning?
I'm good, man. I'm happy to be here. Ready to go. Got the Fifth Amendment on deck.
The Fifth Amendment, that's like the most important amendment of all of the amendments, isn't it?
It's one of them. My favorites are the First and the Fourth. But took over the Fourth last week, did a great job. I'm sick because I couldn't make it. But, we're fired up. We got a good show.
I hate it when that happens. So we got the Fifth Amendment, and we know that the amendments were all placed before us by our forefathers. And we know that Congress adopted those amendments when the Constitution was adopted, that they were Federalist and states' rights people that were bumping heads on each other with regard to the Constitution. The Federalist gave in, if you may, and came up with 10 amendments. The Federalists then decided, hey, wait a minute, we not so sure about this, but then they went ahead and ratified the Constitution. And the preamble of the Constitution of the United States that was held, the Congress was held in New York on the 4th of March, 1789, and it says the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the benefit ends of its institution. In other words, what they're doing here is letting the states' rights people know that they will be protected with the Bill of Rights. Then we go to the Fifth Amendment. We've already talked about 1, 2, 3, 4, and now 5 today. And Attorney Benson Watson is going to tell us about the Amendment number 5, which reads, "No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on the presentation, presentment, or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces, or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any way, any criminal case, to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." Now that is a mouthful, isn't it?
So we talked about, we spoke about, if you look at the Fifth Amendment, you'll see that it's pretty much broken down into 5 parts. You're going to have the grand jury requirement, the indictment requirement, and that's going to be interpreted not just for capital crimes, it's going to be interpreted for felonious crimes, felonies, anything that's a serious crime.
Well, I've often heard that the grand jury is sort of a rubber stamp process. What's the grand jury all about?
Okay, so as far as grand jury here in Texas, that's what we're going to talk about. It's not incorporated. That portion of the Fifth Amendment is not incorporated. We talk about what incorporated means. When the Civil War came about, we wanted to enforce the Southern states to comply with the Constitution and give certain civil liberties to people of that otherwise would not have had them, otherwise known as the freedmen. Okay, we wanted to make sure that the states complied with the Constitution and gave these rights and followed, and we kind of wanted to establish kind of a union. Of we wanted to bring our states back together and establish some kind of glue. So we had the 14th Amendment. It incorporated, that means it incorporated certain rights to the states that were in the feds, because before that, the federal Constitution probably did not apply, you know, on a large scale, did not apply to the states. So this, when we talk about incorporation, the grand jury requirement is one of these five. Is, you know, it's the grand jury, double jeopardy, self-incrimination, and the due process and the takings clause. We're going to talk about all five today. But as far as the grand juries, that one's not incorporated. And you had the state level on most states, even though it did not apply to the states. Most states, other than I think it's Pennsylvania and Connecticut, have grand jury clauses. Back in the day of the founding, and this goes directly to answer your question. In the day of the founding, this was important because you would have a grand jury of people that were local, and you may have some kind of violation of a offense that was promulgated, that was made or created by the crown, okay, or parliament. And so, and that didn't really apply to the colonies. And so a lot of times they'd use the Stamp Act, things that there weren't representation on that weren't looked at favorably from the local standpoint. So the grand juries played a very important role in the day of the founding, because they were able to say, we're not going to indict a local brethren for a violation of this dumb stamp tax act that we didn't have a right to even talk about over in England, but they tried to apply there today. But today,
now that Stamp Act, that was what brought the Boston Tea Party on.
Yeah, it was all together. Exactly. We had taxes on stamps. We had taxes on tea and other exports, imports that we had no right to say. We talked about the quartering acts. The quartering acts allowed soldiers to stay in your own place, which was another form of taxation.
So those taxes weren't applied to goods in England?
No, it was applied only in the colony states. And so that's why this was such a big push. Why are you applying it to us? And we don't have representation about whether or not they go into effect. And how do people in England know about the local environment? How do they know what it costs to run a business here in the colonies? How do they know what it costs to run ships?
We had no voice in Parliament then either.
Correct. Okay. And so to pass these acts, and it wasn't just taxes, but it was, those were big things, okay, but those to violate some of those laws were looked at disfavorably. To say that the local person in the colonies violated those things were looked at disfavorably in the commonplace and to the common people. And so these grand juries would step in and essentially stonewall, right, I would say now it would be the equivalent of a federal prosecutor, which would be the representative of the crown, coming in and saying, we're going to get you indicted for violation of the Stamp Act or any other kind of promulgation, any other kind of regulation that was made, right, from Britain or England at that time. The grand juries would step in and prevent that from happening here. Then fast forward a couple centuries. And
here we are.
And we have a bologna sandwich. So, in other words, it's a famous joke that a prosecutor can essentially get a ham sandwich indicted and if they wanted to. And we did have some grand jury reform. I don't want to say that the grand juries play absolutely no role. And oftentimes we can submit a grand jury packet. If it's the right case, if it's a questionable case. We also had several cases that we talked about on here where grand juries actually get the DA out of hot water.
Okay. Right?
A lot of times the district attorney doesn't want to bring a case. A lot of times he, in a self-defense case, say, but that was maybe halfway questionable, or that maybe it was a good self-defense case, but maybe it was an unfavorable person that used the self-defense against a really favorable person in the community.
Okay, so the DA has to do something.
He has to do something because it's like, oh man, I got a bunch of people complaining. So they go to the grand jury, submit it to the grand jury, and you know all this is secret, right? So unless you've been a district, unless you've been a prosecutor, unless you've been a felony prosecutor, you're the only, it's hard to have knowledge unless you've been a prosecutor or also on the grand jury. And so, but essentially there's no regulations, there's no procedure, or at least there had been for a long time, and there's still really not anything set in stone about what procedure you use to present your case to the grand jury, which is both dangerous and favorable, right? Because they could present it in such a way, man, this guy's guilty. I've been dealing with this guy forever. I'm getting tired of him. I may not have a good case here, guys, but he's dealing dope, and I think you guys should just charge him with this so that I got leverage.
Okay.
And they may indict him. But, in you know, from the other standpoint, he could go, man, this is, I've got no choice to bring this. I don't want to bring this case.
The evidence is weak, man.
It's weak, and I don't really like the way this is presented. It's just I got a lot of on my back, and I'm just hoping you guys do the right thing.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Kind of thing. And so, sure. So the grand jury can play a very important role, especially from a political standpoint. They can help calm and quell, you know, outcries to say go after somebody when it's really not just to do so. And the district attorney can use that as a device to prevent, right, injustice. The district attorney can also use it as a device for injustice on the other side, right, to go after somebody that doesn't need to be used for. But all in all, I think it still plays some kind of role. I think at the end of the day, they do no bill, people. They do no bill, and it's not all for political stuff. Sometimes the district attorney brings, that we talked about, and I've got his permission, Harold Weezer. We talk about Harold Weezer's case from Rosebud, where he flicked off the police officer, drove by after several outlaws. It was outside the police officer's authority, okay. And they ended up, I think, storming his house with SWAT, not everything, and charging him with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon on a police officer. It would have been a first degree felony.
Yeah, but Harold's a friend of mine, and I don't know if you know it, but just yesterday, Court of Appeals, the United States Federal Court of Appeals, says that free speech involves holding up your middle finger at a police officer.
So they've
so Harold was way ahead of his time. Congratulations, Harold.
But to that aspect, the grand jury did no-bill that first degree felony, which was very important. And I mean, it did take the case down a notch and said and got everybody, even the government side, look, if you're going to charge them, that's fine, but you're not going to charge them with, if you think you got a case, present it, but you ain't going to come in here and go with this outlandish charges that really, really have no basis in law or fact. And so I think that the grand jury at the end of the day does play some kind of role, but like you said, for the most part, they do rubber stamp whatever the district attorney wants, and I don't mind saying that. And I think probably a lot of district attorneys will tell you that.
Well, that's where I've heard it.
I mean, and so, from that standpoint, that's the first part of the Fifth Amendment. And so, again, even though the Fifth Amendment doesn't make the grand jury clause applicable here, and that's going to only apply in Texas as well on felony cases, it is important because it does apply in Texas because we have our own constitutional sections about this. We have our own statutes about how the grand jury operates. If you want more about that, you can also reach out, I'm sure, on Google or even holler at me by email.
Then it goes on to talk about the military. Apparently, the military tribunal.
Obviously, yeah. Obviously, court martial and the militia. If you got a state militia, the state reserves now probably would be the equivalent to that. They're going to have their own procedures. They're going to have their own process. We're not going to make that apply. But if you're talking about just on the federal level and a federal court procedure, you're going to have to be indicted for a serious felony.
Okay. So this double jeopardy, I've heard a whole lot about that through my years. I've kind of wondered because I'm seeing what I think to be kind of a watering down of that right, because I've heard of people getting tried for a situation, then what seems to be the same set of facts, they get tried for a lesser offense after they're found innocent of the first offense. Tell us about that.
I'm not going to. We talk about how much we avoid this, and when you talk about how much it's been watered down, you're absolutely correct. It's definitely not what it used to be. It does not have the teeth that it used to be, nor do any of the constitutional amendments really to that effect. But it's so complicated. It has gotten so complicated that scholars on both sides of the issue in both camps could disagree. But the general standpoint on your double jeopardy is you're not going to be put in jeopardy of a criminal conviction, of a guilty conviction, more than once. And a lot of times what would happen is, in the day of the founders, right, you would get tried over and over and over and over again, okay? And not only would this have this psychological effect on you, but it would have an economic effect on you.
Oh, absolutely.
And you would essentially bring down businesses, okay, because they would spend all their money litigating with the government instead of, right, spending it towards their business, and they would go out of business, and so the government would get the outcome that it wanted, even though it didn't get a criminal conviction. And so what the framers here are trying to do is prevent both psychological and economic, right, injury. They don't want you to just be tried over and over and over and over again. However, they develop different standards now that if it's got one element that the other one did not, and when you talk about elements, so it would be like if it was burglary, a standard burglary, it's just a breaking and entering of a habitation, okay, at nighttime. Okay, and so each one of those things, okay, with the intent to commit another felony therein, okay? And so each one of those things is an element, right? Each one of those things, breaking, entering, habitation, nighttime, specific intent to commit another kind of crime.
And they don't have to try all those at the same time. They can split them up.
They can split them. What do you mean by that? What do you mean?
Well, we can have one trial for where it involves some of the elements for some crime, and then, well, okay, let me think of an idea. Somebody who's charged with homicide with a deadly weapon when they're drunk and driving a car.
Okay.
They go to trial, and the jury says, no homicide. Can they then be retried for DWI?
So traditionally, I would have told you absolutely not. I would say that the DWI was encompassed, right, because you would have had to have been driving the vehicle, which would have been your deadly weapon. They're saying that it was, right, it depends on, so normally, yes, I would have said that would have been subsumed. It would have been encompassed by your larger case. The DWI would have been encompassed by your case of homicide, but now
it would seem to me that that's what double jeopardy is all about. But go ahead. But now,
what if they never did make an allegation about you being intoxicated from using the vehicle?
Okay. If they did not make that allegation?
If they did not make that allegation.
Okay, what if they submitted the proof?
Then I would say traditionally, yes, but now the courts are sometimes saying, and I'm telling you, I don't even feel comfortable giving you a definitive answer on any of this.
Well, I understand.
Because it's so hotly contested right now.
It's
actually a hot topic, right? And so you would have probably some courts tell you that there was an element within the DWI that wasn't an element that required proof on the homicide trial. And so because one required an element that the other one did not, then it would not be double jeopardy. And they could come back and try you on the DWI. I think a lot of courts would tell you, no, there's no way. That's absolutely. That's what the proof was, is that he was reckless or that he was indifferent to life because he was intoxicated at the time. I just think that all of these cases, you never know what you're going to get with a double jeopardy claim.
Well, in Texas, the high court is the court of criminal appeals with regard to these matters, right?
Correct, but they haven't spoken on
what are the two
names.
Kinds of errors that they recognize?
Absolute reversible error, and then just does it affect your substantial rights?
Well, I've heard the two kinds is the harmless error and the error that was not
reversible.
Yeah, well,
or constitutional.
The one that was not mentioned by the lawyer in the court. In other words. Yeah, the two kinds of errors that they really don't matter. In other words, they uphold the conviction.
Yes, okay, yeah,
that's
I got
the
you.
Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas. So that's why you're having a difficult time talking about it. Okay, so on television, we've heard over and over again, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. Now tell us, Ross, real short, and then you can elaborate. What should we do when we hear those words spoken to our face?
I think there was a good Facebook out by some lawyers in Vegas. There was a lot of people have been seeing, and their whole thing to the title to their little video that they did was just shut up.
Just shut up. Okay, sounds like.
So I think that gives you a really good idea about what you should do, how you should use this Fifth Amendment, right? And it's definitely something that should be used a whole lot more.
It should be. And when you get to the jail and your wife comes in and asks you what's going on, what happened? What should you do there?
You should technically with your wife, you're going to have a privilege. You're going to have a spousal privilege, okay? But they're going to record. They're going to record you. Like what Rick was, we were about to say at the exact same time. They're going to record you, and they're going to have on that recording that it's being recorded, and you are submitting and giving consent to us for this recording right before you do talk to them. So, in that effect, it's not going to be privileged anymore, and they're going to be able to use that recorded conversation. Also, if your wife comes to see you at jail and they don't have the pre-recording before she talks to you in the phone through the booth, I assure you that they're going to have some sort of sign. They're going to have a sign either in the hallway before you get to the room. They're going to have the signs out in the room where you're talking. They're going to have the signs out on the wife's side somewhere. They're going to have a sign somewhere telling you that that all of the conversations are being recorded. Even if they don't have the sign, I'm telling you, you need to be careful about what you say in those conversations, because I can tell you, I have lost cases before the cases ever got started for what people have said on the jail recordings. Okay, and so just be careful about what you say. I hope none of the listeners are going to go to jail. But I'm just telling you, maybe if you got a loved one that's in there and he's trying to tell you about what happened over the phone, maybe you say, look, I listened to Ben Watson on the radio this morning, and he said that maybe we shouldn't talk about this right now. Okay, and so that's something I can't stress enough. I'm glad you brought that up. I wasn't even going to talk about the recorded phone calls at the jail, but absolutely, you got to be careful. And then, hey, depending on what kind of case it is, the love of your life could be trying to set you up, right, on those recorded conversations. And so just be on the lookout for that in a family law case to come in the near future.
Can the love of your life waive the privilege, or do you have to waive the privilege?
Depends on what it's about. If it's going to be about a family violence or something that happened within the home or to that effect, then obviously that privilege is not going to apply to her. She can waive that. But if it's going to be about some kind of communication that you made to that spouse that is relating to a crime that's just happened to be part of conversations you had with your significant other, then you can invoke the spousal privilege, which means you can prevent your spouse from testifying.
Okay. Okay. So what else you got for us on self-incrimination?
So on self-incrimination, here, this is what we talk about when somebody says, they call in and says, well, he didn't let me talk to my lawyer, or, you know, they didn't read me my Miranda rights. I get that all the time. I mean, people call in all the time, right, with some sort of problem. They think that they want me to get their case thrown out because the police officer didn't read you Miranda.
Technical oust.
Yeah, so that's going to be, you know, you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. You have the right to terminate questioning at any time. Okay, those are going to be, when you read you your Miranda, those are going to be the rights that I'm talking about. And here's the thing. Miranda's not going to get your case thrown out most of the time anyway, even if it's violated. All Miranda's going to talk about is statements, testimonial statements by you that would be used as evidence in your trial. So let's say that you get stopped and there's evidence of marijuana. He smelled the marijuana. Maybe the dog hit. Maybe they never even asked you. Maybe we're not even talking about any statements, but then they got the marijuana. They found it right there in the console of your truck because you weren't smart enough to put it right under the seat or anything else. Right, and you left it right there, or maybe burning in the ashtray. Okay, and so we're going to take that, and we're going to use that to prosecute. Nothing about Miranda is going to affect any of that physical evidence. That would be something you would be hoping for the Fourth Amendment to come in and help you out.
That's kind of a different sort of self-incrimination when you leave it burning in the ashtray.
What self-incrimination might be, and we're going to get into it. I'll start with the issues. And it really doesn't affect it, but I'm going to start with what it could affect. Is what you say. So if you say there's the marijuana burning in the ashtray, that's it. The issue is going to be, does that statement, because that's incriminatory, right? That actually incriminates you and shows that was yours. You knew where it was. You obviously were in control of it because it was in maybe your car. You had knowledge about what was going on, the confines, the scenario within the environment itself. You had knowledge about what the environment was. So you're trying to throw that out because you want to say that that blunt was the passenger's. Okay? Now I've got to figure out a way to make Miranda come into play. Well, I'm not probably in that scenario. Roadside questioning in a DWI situation. You get stopped. He's asking about DWI. Right? That has been, by law, by the courts. I don't know why. I don't necessarily agree with the ruling in all respects.
But I only had two drinks.
Exactly. They'll tell you that everybody says two drinks, so maybe you want to think about a different way to say that, and I will tell you.
You can't win for losing on that. You know, the prosecutor tells the jury he said he only had two drinks, and then he laughs, and all the jurors laugh.
So you gotta be careful about what it is that you say. But if you say two drinks right there, right away, you're giving the police officer a reason to think that you're somewhat intoxicated. And remember, you don't have to be .08. You do not have to be .08 to be intoxicated. The police officer can make his own determination, his own opinion, right, that you have lost the use of your mental or physical faculties. Okay, and so you don't even have to be a .08. And with that being said, the police officer could still get probable cause to arrest you for a DWI even with two drinks. Maybe you're a person that has some kind of extra effect to alcohol that others don't. Maybe you're somebody that has a health, right, some kind of health condition that makes you more susceptible to the effects of alcohol. Maybe you're a person that's on another kind of medication that makes you more susceptible to the effects of alcohol. And so that officer can still say, and I'm not saying he's going to win at jury trial, but we're not talking about that. I'm trying to save you from getting arrested. Okay, but if you're telling him two drinks, that may be enough to give him probable cause, depending on the circumstances. Now, if the video shows the guy's walking fine, talking fine, absolutely. I've had a police officer say on tape before, I don't know what the police officer was thinking. He said, oh, you're walking fine and talking fine, so why are you saying you got all these problems? Well, I used that against him in a motion to suppress. So you said he was walking fine and talking fine, so yeah. Then obviously he wasn't intoxicated.
Okay.
Anyway, I got off on a little tangent.
That took away his probable cause.
We were able to get that case thrown out. But, so police officers, if you're listening, hey, be careful about what you say. DWI stop too. but you gotta be careful about what you say. And I'm going to get to the point. I'm sorry I digress a little bit. It's ADHD in me. But we're getting to, are you in custody and are you being interrogated? So the roadside, we know that the roadside questionings on a DWI stop is not what we call custodial interrogation. You're not going to be in custody and you're not going to be being interrogated. So then at what point are we in custody and are we being interrogated?
Well, when they read those Miranda rights, I think that's a pretty good ticket to.
Well, yeah, if they do read it. So if you're in the car and the police are, whoa, man, what's that smell? You got marijuana? You say, yeah, officer, I got it right here in the car. At that point, you were never placed in custody, and so at the first instance, we got to ask, what is custody? From the Fourth Amendment standpoint, seizure is easy. Okay, seizure is any kind of like submission to a show of authority.
Yeah, they put you in handcuffs.
Well, is handcuffs only a seizure? Or is that custody?
No, I would think it's both. They seize your body.
Exactly. So a custody is always a seizure, but a seizure is not always custody.
Okay.
So you can be detained. I don't know if you guys got into Terry style. I told you I didn't want to watch your
just a little bit
deal,
yeah,
because I was so upset
on the Fourth Amendment. Yeah.
So in traffic stop situation, and I'm going to go into a little bit of the Fourth Amendment here. In a traffic stop situation, we're both looking at, right, the detention. It's sort of like a Terry stop, and Terry. He was a well-versed cop that was walking the beat of the street in downtown, see some guys walking around a building, and they keep walking around. They walk across the street, walk around a building, walk across the street, walk around a building, and they walk across the street, talk to another guy. Well, they ain't looking for the Saturday sale.
Yeah.
Okay, they're not going to the front door. They're not walking in. They're walking around the building, looking through the windows at each one. They're casing the place.
Right.
Okay, and so what Mr. Officer McFadden did in Terry, and this was in Ohio, he walks up to him, and he's like, what are you guys doing? What are you guys up to? And they start acting really nervous, right? He knows one of them, right? And then he sees a bulge. He says, man, and he pushes him up against the wall, does a really quick Terry pat down for weapons because he's starting to fear for his life. He was just going to question them about what they were doing.
Right.
Okay, and so under the Fourth Amendment, when he walks up and questions those guys, that's a seizure.
Okay.
So that would be a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and he would now have to have what we call reasonable suspicion, which is just slightly less than probable cause. It's saying there's something there telling me that there's criminal activity afoot. I can't put my hand on it. I can't say that criminal activity happened. I can't say, maybe it has happened, but I can't say for sure, but I know that there is something based on criminal activity, connected to criminal activity, that allows me to come in and at least ask a couple of questions. Very briefly. It's very brief. Stop. Okay? And it's not something that you can sit there and hold them forever just on based on what Officer McFadden saw. Right? But then he saw the nervous activity with the bulge, right? And then had a reason to pat them down, which led now to the Terry pat down law. It made that, that's what allowed that case allowed police officer to pat you down. So
that's primarily for the protection of the officer, right?
Yes, absolutely, for protection of the officer. So there's got to be some evidence that the officer perceives to show him that there's a threat to officer safety. Okay, so taking that into consideration of traffic stops, when you actually violate the traffic law, when you speed, that's probable cause. Okay, now I don't want to get into the it's a custodial arrest and things like that. But technically, under the Constitution, and this was a Atwater versus Lago Vista, this was a Texas case, Atwater versus Lago Vista, the lady didn't have her seatbelt on and got arrested. The police officer arrested her with her two kids in the car. We talked about that. It was really unreasonable, right? And so she appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court said, under the Constitution, under the common law, that's what we look at. Was it unreasonable? No, because there was probable cause to arrest her. She broke the law. She could be arrested. So, with a traffic offense, that's what's funny about this, is that there could be probable cause to arrest for a traffic offense. But we look at a traffic stop in Terry. We look at it as a detention. It needs to be no longer than necessary to write the ticket and let you go. Okay? Or if you're going to arrest him, you need to go ahead and arrest him. Okay? You can get arrested, right, for violating traffic, but that doesn't happen. But the officer's got a very short time to make up his mind. So, in that seizure, he doesn't have long to make up his mind whether you're going to be seized, right, or whether you're going to be arrested. And so then you've got to make your determination, okay, if he puts you in cuffs, is that an arrest? Probably, but not all the time, right? Not all the time, because you could be, maybe the circumstances develop really quick. The officer needs to figure out whether or not you are who you say you are, or whether or not the other person, maybe he puts you in handcuffs for his own safety just to make sure. So that's just a detention.
Okay,
versus an arrest. So we're looking at, is it the functional equivalent of an arrest? And it could be because there's 20 officers, you know, all surrounding a guy with guns. I would say that that's probably an arrest. But he's not in handcuffs. So handcuffs aren't determinative, but they are persuasive.
I would say so.
If you've ever been in handcuffs, you know what I'm talking about.
They're pretty persuasive.
That's like what Clyde and I used to say, if hire us. We've been arrested. We know what you we know what you're going through. So, not you. I'm speaking for myself here. but yeah, you got to ask: are you in custody? And all these things come into play. Remember, they've got so much time to act. Well, if they go outside that scope, they're gonna have to arrest you. And so, I think if they continue to hold you there, right, for too long, they're gonna look at that is either an arrest or an invalid detention. Okay, under Terry. So it's either going to be an arrest or an invalid detention. If they don't have a reason to prolong the traffic stop, there's not going to be a reason for them under the Fourth Amendment to justify their actions. So then they're going to have to... But if there is, then they've got a lawful stop and you're in custody. Okay, so now, then, even though you're in custody, is it interrogation? Okay, and so I know I'm getting excited about this, and it's a lot.
Well, I can tell you love it, but that's the criminal lawyer in you coming out.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And so there is a process you go by to make sure you see these facts, and you always start with the Fourth Amendment to make sure you've got a valid stop, a valid seizure, and does that seizure escalate to custody?
That's why you got to go to Benton Ross Watson when you have a situation like this, because he knows the steps.
Well,
we have a two more out of five that we need to talk to in a few minutes. So
I'm gonna talk next week when we get to the Sixth Amendment about interrogation more.
Okay.
And so I wasn't gonna harp too much on interrogation, but is it calculated to elicit an incriminating response? Right? If you blurt out that there's marijuana or drugs in your car or something like that, you're not going to be protected by the Fifth Amendment. Okay? It's self-incrimination. You cannot be compelled. It cannot make you come to grand jury up here, right, and testify, right, to where it incriminates you. Same thing. A police officer cannot force you to incriminate yourself. And they also can't use tactics, which we're going to talk about next week in a very good case out of Rhode Island, right? Can't use tactics that are calculated to make you, right, say something incriminating. They know, right? They know that, well, they can, right? If you've waived your Miranda, if they read your Miranda, but they haven't, then they've got to be very careful. So we're going to talk about the consequences of that, right, next week. But for the fourth section of the Fifth Amendment is the due process. And for due process, we have both procedural and substantive.
Now, I know that due process is a mighty big part of the Fifth Amendment, and that might be something that could take a whole session, frankly, because it is complex and complicated. But if we only have a few more minutes here, Ross.
Yeah, so. But if you remember, we had the Third Amendment, and it was quartering of soldiers, where soldiers took over their house without your consent. And so we talked about, there really hasn't been any good cases litigated, but what the Third Amendment was important for is showing us that there was rights implied by design within the Constitution. In other words, the First Amendment says speech, but it doesn't say conduct. So there had to be some implication that speech was broader than just verbal.
Kind of like Harold's case, lifting of the middle finger.
Right. It involved more. There was more rights involved than simply what the Constitution said. And so procedural is going to speak to notice. Okay, did you get notice like you're supposed to under the rules? The other one is going to be substantive, right? Are your rights violated in such a way that you cannot use, right, other implied rights that we talked about, those penumbras, those rights that maybe, is there some kind of disadvantage given to you by the under the First Amendment, and that would allow you to also make a Fifth Amendment claim? And that would be vagueness, overbreath, right? A lot of times you can tie in, and that would be like if a statute you can't understand what the statute's meaning is. And so because you can't understand what the statute's meaning is, you don't know what the process is going to be in order if you want to exercise your rights. And so it puts a chill on your exercise of your other important rights. And so that would be a Fifth Amendment claim under due process. Takings, we talked about, I think it's relevant to today with the pipelines.
Well, back to due process. I know that there's a lot of U.S. Supreme Court cases that imply, if you may, or apply the due process clause to a broad area of cases. In other words, due process has to be given to almost any situation involving the taking of property or the taking of assets or taking of your body.
Correct. All that. Due process is applicable in all.
And that was applied in the 14th Amendment, I believe?
Both, yes. So that's what I was trying to say. The 14th Amendment is going to have a due process clause on it as well. You're also going to have your substantive, just generally, you're going to have your substantive and your procedural due process rights, okay, talked about. And so when you hear lawyers talk about your procedural due process, you're talking about notice and things like that in an adjudication, in a some kind of proceeding. When you talk about your substantive rights, that's saying there's been some kind of law or the law is unclear as far as exercising my other constitutional rights.
Now, this last part says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. I know here in Milam County, we have several pipelines coming across.
Correct.
And it's eminent domain. Whenever a power line goes through or a road goes through, eminent domain. Is that what we're talking about here, Ross?
Correct. So the state's going to have the right to come in and take private property as long as they pay you the fair market value at the time of the taking for that property. Now,
so just compensation, I mean, when you say
a fair market value,
that's like, well, you know, I have a big old oak tree and I'm going to build my house there. I've been wanting to build my house there for a long time and I'm going to retire and I want to put my, and they're going to put a power line right over the top of that and knock that oak. I am so upset. To me, the market value is a lot higher than market value, right?
Correct. And then you got people that are out saying, you know, I'll sell to whatever somebody's willing to pay. Well, what the Supreme Court or what a Texas Supreme Court is probably going to say about what somebody's willing to pay is what a willing buyer, non-coerced, non-pressured buyer would be willing to pay, taking the advantages and disadvantages of the property. Okay, and so what that means, who knows? That's why there's a lot of good lawyers out there that do nothing but eminent domain, and they are going to argue, right, on specific types of cases that certain property is way more valuable than what the government is saying that it is, and obviously you can have huge litigation over this. Yeah.
I've been involved in some of those cases involving power lines and others involving pipelines, and obviously when you put a power line through that's got about 8 wires and these big, huge towers, it's going to affect the property value of the whole of the property. You know, if you got 500 acres and it goes across the side of
correct.
It'll affect the whole property. Whereas the neighbor who's just across the gravel road, he gets nothing because even though the power line's sticking up right next to his house, They haven't taken anything according to our law. So that's a tricky thing when you start talking about the whole of the property and the value lost. Anyway, that's another good place to think about getting a lawyer because, you know, the power line companies, the pipeline companies, they all want to stick it through as fast and as easy and as cheaply as possible. So they're not going to come in and offer you what you could get if you had a good lawyer.
And you have these great debates, right? Because you say it's got to be for a public use, but the pipeline companies are going to make all the money.
Yeah.
Pipeline companies and the oil companies and the shippers and transporters are going to be the ones that make all the money. So where's the public use coming in?
That's right. So
The public use is going to come from the lower gas prices because transportation is cheaper and overall market and economies of scale kind of thing come into play. And because we can transport it to Houston from Lubbock to Houston much quicker with a pipeline, it's going to show up at the pump.
Commerce clause, I think, is what you're talking about.
But that's going to say that's the public use. That's what we get. And same with the economic renovation stuff in Kello and Berman and
Ross,
Hawaii.
We're going to have another segment after tactical snacking. Would you be willing to hang in here with me and talk about guns a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, tell us how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, if you guys, we always love questions. We get a lot of emails, been getting a lot of emails. Go ahead and email me at Benton@Watson.legal. That's Benton@Watson.legal. Make sure you leave your phone number because I can't always get an email back to you, but it's a lot easier for me to call you sometimes. But you can call us at 254-605-4140. That's 254-605-4140. Or come see me down here in Cameron at 105 East Main Street. Big Milk Cow on the side. Can't miss it. Or call us for an appointment in Brazos County or down in Houston. So I look forward speaking with you guys about the show.
Thank you. My name is Richard Dodd, and you can get in touch with me by email at justice@respectforyou.com or just go on the web at respectforyou.com and send us a note, or you can call us at 254-697-4965. Now, y'all hang on because we're going to have a segment called Tactical Snacking with the delicious Renee Goodman. And today, I wouldn't call it snacking because it has to do with composting. And what is it? How do you do it? And what is it good for? So y'all hang on.
Capellino Krebs Law Firm in Cameron focuses on cases involving personal injury litigation, including asbestos exposure and mesothelioma. At Capellino Dodd Krebs Law Firm, you are never treated like a number. Cases are accepted on a contingency basis, so clients do not have to pay out of their pocket. Contact Capellino Dodd Krebs Law Firm in Cameron today. Call 888-MESO-FIRM.
Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures. If you've decided to carry a handgun for self-defense, you better know what you're doing. If you don't, you better learn fast. Not only fast, but thoroughly. Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures fills the void between a Johnny wannabe and a person who has been properly trained in the proper handling and use of a firearm. Call me, Matt Betros, at 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com and set up a class or seminar to get you started on the road to proficiency with a firearm for self-defense. Go to our website, aaronsgunshop.com, and review the High Cap Adventures page. We have seminars to cover most forms of firearms training. Call 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com to get more information on how to get started with your training. The time for games is over. Reality starts now. aaronsgunshop.com.
Hello, my lovelies, and a happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I've got some composting tips to help you stay green. If you missed last week's segment about sprucing up your garden for spring, be sure to check it out at thecultivatedclassroom.com. I'm Janae Goodman, and this is Tactical Snacking. What on earth is compost? If you're keen on gardening, chances are that you've heard the word, but I can still help you out with a formal definition. Compost is decayed organic material that can be used as plant fertilizer. It is a pile made up of mostly plant and raw food materials, and there are a handful of things to do to ensure your compost pile is hot, heaping, and healthy. For starters, what can you compost? Plant materials such as tree bark, broken down sticks, and withered crops, fruit and veggie scraps, or things like leafy tops or peels or stems, eggshells, some paper-based materials which include coffee filters, paper bags, newspapers, and shredded cardboard. You can also do loose coffee grounds and tea leaves, or waste from herbivorous animals, such as horses, chickens, and rabbits. Remember to break down larger items like sticks and cardboard to avoid a longer breakdown time of your compost. Along with that list comes a number of items that you do not want to introduce to your compost pile. Things such as meat and fish, or waste from carnivorous animals. This includes dogs and cats. Milk or dairy. Whole eggs. Remember, only the egg shells. Cooked food and leftovers. And glossy and ink-based paper. That includes stickers you find on your produce. Plastic and glass do not break down, so be sure to leave those in a recycling bin instead. You'll also want to avoid adding any large amount of citrus peels. Avoid adding treated wood and synthetic or chemical-based fertilizers as well. Citrus peels can ward off any insects that you need to make your compost pile thrive. Meats and dairy can add quite a stench when they decompose. They also attract unwanted rodents to your compost, meaning potential diseases and unwanted bacteria that's passed on to you. Man-altered materials such as glossy and ink-based papers carry chemicals. This, of course, being the same issue with synthetic fertilizers and chemical-based pesticides. Newspaper is safe because most of them are printed using a soybean oil-based ink. You must remember that compost will be used to make recycled soil, so you don't want to introduce chemicals or rodents to your crops. Don't introduce them to your organic matter pile. If you're looking at starting a compost pile at home, you'll want to start directly on Mother Nature. This allows for beneficial insects to find their way to your pile. Next, stack a layer of sticks and twigs, which allows your pile to drain water and allows for aeration. Then, you'll want to alternate between green and brown layers. The green layers are made up of living organic materials, such as grass clippings or those food scraps and withered plants we mentioned earlier. The brown layers are comprised of items like hay, dried leaves, tree bark, basically any dry organic plant materials. When you're done alternating between the green and the brown layers, water it plenty. Your compost should be moist, but it should not be continuously soaked. Overwatering will cause your pile to rot in all the wrong ways. Keeping too dry of a compost pile, however, will elongate the amount of time that it takes for your pile to break down, so be sure to incorporate water occasionally or put it in a place that it gets ample rain. Once it's nice and finely watered, cover your compost. You can do so with a tarp, wood slats, plastic sheets, or whatever you may have on hand. You'll also want to turn your compost pile every few weeks. This means that you take a large shovel or a pitchfork and toss your materials around like a salad. This allows for air to be introduced to your pile, meaning that items break down just a tad bit faster. When adding new items to your compost, be sure to cover them with existing compost layers. There's no need to layer new items, but you don't want to attract fruit flies or any other rodents. If a pile seems like an eyesore, you lack the room for one, you can always opt for a compost barrel instead. Compost barrels or tumblers are handy because they make it easy to incorporate new material into your compost. Not to mention that they're less work when it comes to aerating. Plus, if you have some energetic kids around, they love helping you spin the barrel. A healthy compost pile should incorporate FBI. If the feds are knocking at your door, I hate to break it to you, but it has nothing to do with your composting skills. We're talking about fungi, bacteria, and invertebrates. Mold and mushrooms are wonderful for breaking down organic materials because of a natural enzyme they possess. Bacteria warms up your compost pile, and as bacteria breaks down organic matter, nutrients are released into the compost. Invertebrates, or animals that don't have backbones, allow air into your organic matter while also breaking down materials by eating them. Composting comes with a heap of benefits. Primarily, adding compost to your soil gives your crops a boost of nutrients. It also attracts beneficial bugs to your garden beds. This includes worms, beetles, and spiders. Lastly, composting allows you to recycle food regardless of if you have a garden or not. Studies have shown that composting can actually eliminate up to 30% of waste in your home trash can, and that means less waste overall. So whether you're a green thumb gardener or not, I encourage you to compost. Be sure to drop a line at tacticalsnacking@yahoo.com if you wish to inquire more about composting or kitchen skills. Be safe, enjoy your St. Patrick's Day, and until next time, stay hungry, my friends.
All right, respectforyou.com, remember that. How can you forget it, huh?
Hey, I'm just trying to hope the judges remember it.
Respect for me. We demand it. All right, Mr. Watson, let's talk a little bit about guns. I mean, it is a gun show. Have you been involved with, handled any gun cases, shootings or possession, unlawful? I mean, you know, something to do with
guns. Yeah, I tell you.
Let's talk about some true stories here.
Yeah, several, I mean, but we definitely don't like those cases because it just complicates the matter, especially with today, with the political pressure behind it. And I thank goodness that we live in a more rural society that's more accepting than where we were, say, if you know, you were in somewhere in Ohio or D.C., District of Columbia. Because, goodness, if you're up there, you're just, it's almost like you're a child molester. You just got some kind of gun crime.
Well, you know, the old saying, caught with a smoking gun, I mean, it's pretty damning.
And so, yeah, but sometimes it's taken out of context. But you have cases, I think, that show the consequences of dealing with that, especially from the civil side, which we don't see on this show a lot. So I'm glad you're here to talk about that.
Yeah, happy to be here. Tell us a little bit about a couple of your cases. You don't have to name names or anything, but surely there's a story or two in there.
People fiddling with a firearm and when they're not supposed to be even around them.
Fiddling.
Shooting them. Yeah. not necessarily intentionally doing something wrong, but maybe they're otherwise not supposed to be around them. Maybe their parents said you're not supposed to go around them, and then ended up, you know, pulling the trigger or hitting the firing pin. Had two of those cases, ended up hitting another person.
Now, had several. Texas, it's a crime, isn't it, to allow a minor access to a gun?
Correct. So you gotta be careful about what minors you had. Had a couple of those cases. We've had other cases, I think, that have happened more than you think. And Matt's always talking about, don't just shoot your firearm up in the air, because the bullet's going to come down. It's simple physics, right? It's what we call trigonometry. And so it's gonna come down at some point. And so you got to be careful. I can tell you I've had at least two shotgun cases where we've shot up in the air and had the pellets come down on the BBs come down on somebody else's house, on somebody else's car, near somebody else's person, near somebody else's child. And it wasn't intentional by any means, but it definitely gives rise in some cases to a criminal charge, especially when it put some kind of property or person in near danger. And what I mean is, one time I think we had BBs come down, hit a car, and the guy was just 10 feet away. And so that ended up being a reckless discharge kind of case. You can be charged with an assault. You can be charged with an assault, just an assault period, for reckless conduct. Okay, and that bullet can always be what we call your agent. It's just an extension of your body. And so you can always be charged with that assault case, and you can always then be charged with the deadly conduct, and that goes to double jeopardy. If you're charged with the assault, okay, with the deadly weapon, can you also be charged with the deadly conduct? I can tell you right now, we've appealed cases that has been upheld. I disagree with those decisions. I would sit here and just rant for an hour and tell you why those cases are wrong. But like I told you, you would have scholars on both sides of the double jeopardy issue earlier in the earlier discussion talk about why. And so what my purpose of telling you this is, if you've got a firearm involved and you place somebody or property in near danger, don't expect them to come light on you. They're going to bring every possible charge that they can bring if it's the right county and there's the right political players involved.
Or the wrong county.
Or the wrong county.
Have a good look at it. Yeah, exactly. Look at that. So what about illegal carrying firearms? What's the worst case you've ever seen? Somebody who really got nailed.
Worst case, you mean for your client, for
someone who was carrying that weapon?
They're all pretty much, you know, they have a firearm in the car and they're felons. I mean, it's those cases happen just so often, and they're traveling, and sometimes you feel for the person. And I've warned on the show about a couple cases. We had some high school kids aged. I mean, they've been out of high school 1 year, you know, been out of high school 2 years. And for some reason, they were on probation, or they had already had a felony that maybe they took probation for.
Yeah.
And they took it while they were 18, while they were a senior in high school. Now they're 1 year out, 2 years out, in college, helping a roommate move. Okay? And they're moving all this stuff, and either the roommates... I mean, I've had at least five of these, just like this. I mean, just like this. So I'm talking about this case.
Yeah.
These facts. These same facts. I mean, almost not exactly identical, but, I mean, they're so similar that it's just a stark. I mean, it's just crazy how similar the facts are. That the gun's either under the seat in the friend's car that they're helping move, or, right, in one of the bags that they're moving. Okay, it's got a gun. And in four of those five, okay, and one of the five, there was drugs involved. The guys were smoking a little marijuana while they were moving, right, which led to the search, which found the gun, which led to the other charge. But...
Well, you got
to
get your pay some way.
You got to get it through, yeah. So, but in four of them, the only reason we even had a search is the driver is being really upfront, young kid. Driver says... yeah, officers, you got anything in the car I need to be aware of? Yeah, I got my dad's pistol under the seat, or I got, you know, my gun, my hunting rifle, and in a truck with everything else. And then they run the passenger, and the passenger's got a felony, and boom. And it's like, man, this wasn't one of those cases,
but
man.
That wasn't his possession, was it? I mean,
and that's the issue. And so we get whether
he still spends the night in jail.
Exactly. And he still gets arrested. And so a lot of times you would say it is in his possession. Okay. And I would argue that it's not, Rick. I would argue one, too, because you still got the knowledge requirement. In order to be in possession of something, you have to know that it's there to do it voluntarily. And that's the one thing we talk about with jurors. Sometimes when we have a possession case, we'll give them Clyde Chandler, a mentor of mine that I worked with here forever, used to give him one of those Bible.
Yeah.
Used to give one of the jurors, prospective jurors on the veneer panel, and used to give them that and ask them, are you in possession of that? And they'd say, yeah. And he'd say, well, then give me my dollar in there because you're not in possession of that. Right? And they did. They didn't know that the dollar was in there.
Right.
And so if it was a dollar, yeah, they're going to say that was in their possession. But if it's drugs, they're going to say, man, I didn't know that was in there. I thought it was a holy Bible.
Absolutely.
So they're going to say they're not in possession. So those are the unlawful possession cases. I think, yeah, a lot of times possession is an issue. But we have so many segments on this show going into what is and what is not possession and how much you can be litigating. But you don't want to find yourself in a position to have to argue whether or not there was possession.
Have you ever defended a murder case?
No, not the murder case. We've worked on, as co-counsel, a couple of manslaughter cases. We worked on...
Involving firearms?
No, involving vehicles.
Okay. Another deadly weapon, huh?
Yeah, another deadly weapon. Yeah, absolutely. And a knife. But okay. No firearms yet as far as murder cases are concerned.
Well, I've... Ross, I've had a few cases involving firearms as in my career. I remember one involving a BB gun in the eye. These were minor children. Oh, they were preteens, like 12, 13 maybe. And got shot in the eye, and you'd think, well, that's not good. You know, we always learn that we don't play with rattlesnakes and we don't get shot in the eye, right? Well, the young man had what we call traumatic glaucoma, and the parents hired me to do what I could. And we got the homeowner's insurance involved, and they did pay for this young man's medical and his problems that he had to put a drop in his eye each day for the rest of his life because of traumatic glaucoma, so that the glaucoma wouldn't get so bad that he would lose his eye. So yeah, he suffered, and he had problems, and he had medical for a long time, but fortunately, because of medicine, he's doing pretty good today. He continued on through life, played baseball, and has done well. Had another one where it was a little more complicated. Had a pellet gun. You know, we don't think of BB guns and pellet guns as causing a lot of harm. But this fellow, he got shot upside the head when he was about 15 by a buddy of his that was literally shooting at him. But, you know, he didn't think it was going to hurt him. He was real sorry. Yeah, but it hit him in the skull, and it cracked a little bone and caused a little hemorrhaging inside the brain. And fortunately, again, modern medicine helped him through this, and he's doing pretty good these days.
So let me ask you this.
But it was a homeowner's insurance situation.
So in civil, and you're always telling me, I call you routinely with cases, and you're so negative.
Well, it depends on the facts, Ross.
And you're always asking me, well, one, you're asking me a big part of duty. I think in this case, you have a duty not to shoot somebody. I think
that's right.
And you're just breaching like, that duty by doing that.
By shooting them, yeah.
But I think there's another issue then after, in a lot of cases, duty is a big deal, though, with you. And we talk about, do you have a duty? But in this case, we think you had a duty and there was a breach. But then you were going to ask me, well, is that foreseeable? So why don't you explain to everybody, how can you, if let's say the homeowner's insurance wouldn't have covered it, could you have held that guy civilly responsible for that? And two, the homeowners are going to assert the same defense. Maybe it's not foreseeable that that would happen.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking of a couple other situations where I could talk a little bit more about homeowners. The thing is that if it's a crime, and I had one where a shooter just goes crazy and runs up the road with his two pistols, and somebody drives up pulling a horse trailer, and he shoots both of the ladies and kills them.
Wow.
And, you know, it's an intentional act, right? He ran back to his house, and the police came, and they fired canisters of tear gas into it and busted all the windows and broke down the door, and he wound up getting taken out by the police. So he no longer has the homeowner's homestead exemption, you see. So so I'm hired wow. by the minor children to go after the house, which we were able to secure and sell, and got some degree of justice there. I guess we got 100% of what was available. But what you just mentioned would be the what could we get from the 14-year-old? I mean, he has no money. He has no insurance. It was an intentional act. So it wouldn't do you any good to go after him under Texas laws that allow all these exemptions from execution of property, but also an opportunity to take bankruptcy for, you know, like $1,000, you go bankrupt and knock out all your debts. So you got to be practical about it when you spend the kind of money that's necessary to take one of these cases to court. Another case I was handling where a young man was horsing around, fiddling around with his .22 pistol that his grandpa had told him where it was and said, "You're going to get this when I die." The young man literally points it at his buddy's stomach and pulls the trigger. He did not check the chamber, and it fired into the fellow's gut. It did pierce about three pieces of the young man's small intestines. But again, guess what? Modern medicine. They open up the kid, they snip out the little pieces of the intestines that are penetrated. They split them and put them together the way they should. The medical literature tells us that in that event that there is a high degree of likelihood that there will be no problems. 6 months later, the young man is throwing the shot put for his local high school track team.
Oh.
It's like a miracle. I mean, you know, and as far as I know, this has been 20 years ago. From what I understand, he's still doing great, having no problems at all. Again, it's a miracle. That would not have happened 100 years ago or 200 years ago, but good for him. And that was another situation where the homeowners kicked in because the grandfather actually was criminally liable for allowing that child to get a hold of that gun and causing these problems.
And so are you involved on the in any part of the criminal process and talking to the district attorneys or anybody in this, you know, on that side of the wall from when you're representing somebody on the civil side?
Sure. There's always a crimes victim coordinator, and that coordinator helps coordinate situations where if I cannot get any kind of justice, then there's the thing called restitution. So I want to make sure that my client gets some sort of degree of justice, and sometimes that's the last resort.
And now, we've actually gone together on a couple of cases over to the district attorney's office, not in a shooting case, but on some other kind of securities fraud type of cases,
right,
and tried to get them to see the restitution value that needs to be made for some of the folks, local folks here. And I mean,
because we were in a position to recognize a crime.
Correct.
And I feel like as an attorney, an officer of the court, it's our duty to report these kinds of crimes.
Correct.
And, you know, beyond that, it's our duty to help our client. So, again, you know, if you come to me and Ross and you become our client, then there's that certain knowledge that we've gained over the years and our education and experience that can help you. So another case I had involved a shooting in a couple of them, actually, where one where the husband shoots the wife and ex-wife and then takes himself out. And that is another one of those intentional cases that I mentioned where there's no homeowner's insurance. But again, because he's deceased, there is no longer a homestead exemption. And there were a couple of minors involved in that case, and we were able to secure the home, sell the home, and distribute that money. I don't think we took a fee on that case because, you know, it was a situation where they just needed our help, and I was happy to do it. I remember one case, you talk about criminal aspect of it. It was really an interesting situation where a fellow who's going to collect a debt, he loads up his pistol and he goes to a place of business. The person who owed the debt comes walking out of the place of business, and he summons him over to his vehicle and pokes the end of that business end of that barrel out.
Gosh.
And the fellow who owed the debt grabbed the gun and pulled it towards him, allegedly. I mean, this is what the witness, who, by the way, was holding the other end of the gun, was saying. And it shot him right square in the middle of the chest. He fell back dead. So there was an indictment. There was a grand jury finding. There was a trial for murder. And during the process of that, I got involved because the family, of course, was suing the shooter. And the homeowner's insurance was already in the process of having what they call a declaratory judgment, where they were trying to get the judge to rule that because it was an intentional act, they didn't have to pay, they didn't have to defend. But that was successfully held off until the criminal trial occurred, where the shooter got on the witness stand and did a very good job for himself as far as convincing the jury that he had no intent of shooting the deceased. And the jury went with him and found him guilty of negligent homicide, which is a misdemeanor in Texas. But negligence also implies that there was no intent. Therefore, we were able to collect all of that homeowner's insurance for
which
the
kids. Which actually, if people didn't catch it, actually worked out in your favor.
It worked out, yeah.
Because if it's intentional act, the insurance policy may not apply to an intentional act.
It would not imply, yes.
So this actually was helped out from the civil standpoint, yep. Even though it might not have been looked like justice from the criminal side of things, it was a lot more justice
absolutely.
On the civil side of things.
It worked out monetarily for the family. You know, they they were able to have a pretty good life even without the breadwinner being there helping them out. So, you know, that was an interesting case as far as the connection between civil and criminal.
That is. It doesn't happen. We're always talking about that, too. I'll call you with a real bad case, and you'll say, well, that's an intentional act. I mean, the policy's probably not going to apply. I don't know that we can do anything from a civil standpoint. It's going to be more criminal. So I'm not saying
it's really difficult if the tortfeasor or the bad guy is alive because of the Homeowners Homestead Act. Sometimes if we do a lot of asset checks. We have investigators that do that stuff for us. And they might be able to locate oil wells out in West Texas. Voila. If you find that, voila. But it just doesn't happen very often. You know, most of the criminals, they're not out committing the kind of crimes that cause the kind of harm that would justify a civil case if they have oil wells out in West Texas. Now, I have had friends before that have had sexual deviance, you know, just sick people who had a bunch of money who had to pay millions of dollars because of their deviant activities. So there's always a possibility. A lot of folks, have a lot of money, a lot of oil wells out in West Texas who don't act like it. You know, they drive their old 59 Fords and wear their straw hats and they live alone and, you know, take shape from there. So it's
you never know.
I had another case, Ross, where it involved products liability case. It was a situation where he was out with a young man hunting deer. They shot a deer. They were walking up to the deer. The deer jumped, and the young man held the rifle, and it shot my client through the arm, and it, you know, it was a horrible injury. The young man who got shot had been to four or five of the lawyers, and then he came to my office, and he was talking about an insurance policy that did not apply in situations involving family. In other words, this was his nephew, and even though the nephew was covered by liability, it didn't cover him for negligence against another person who was covered in the policy, which would have included my client. So during the conversation, I heard this story, and I said, "Do you still have the gun?" And he said he did. And I said, "Well, you know, when you get home, I want you to call me and tell me what model it is and what it is." And sure enough, it was what I thought he might have, and that is a Remington 700 model, which also has the name of Camp Killer. And this is was a trigger mechanism that was, for whatever reason, I don't want to say it's a little cheaper, but it might have been a little less expensive to build it out of one piece instead of the usual two pieces. And what would happen, you get a little dirt in there, a little moisture in there, a little oil in there, and a little grime, and pretty soon it sticks. And then all of a sudden, it might discharge.
Because your trigger's essentially released, but it's stuck because of all the grime,
exactly.
And so you don't know it.
That's right. That's right. So that there's been a lot of information about that. Now, one thing about products liability. I mean, there are two kinds of products liability. One of this is a design defect, and we hear a whole lot about design defects. Design defects as far as tires go, how they're put together, airbag litigation, rollovers, seat belts. I mean, a lot of those are design defects. This particular one is a design defect. But there's also what you call a manufacturer's defect. That occurs in tires a lot of times when the vulcanization doesn't occur right. They put the wrong kind of rubber in the mold.
For the people in my field, what's vulcanization?
That's where they have two different kinds of rubber, two pieces of rubber that are put together, and when the heat
they
allows
come
them
apart
to actually stick.
Yeah.
So when they vulcanize is when you got trouble.
That's
when
right.
You got trouble. So
is that when you're going to have your blowouts all the time?
Well, not all the time, but yeah. I mean, it's... Typically, there is a separation of the tread, a separation of the sidewall, and the tires blow out. But in guns, what's interesting about gun litigation is that is the only kind of business where the manufacturers of this consumer product is exempt from federal health and safety regulations. Now, I think that's really interesting because there's no federal agency that can require a gun manufacturer to recall a defective gun. Now, in this case, Remington did recall their Model 700, but guess what? They recalled it back to about 10 or 15 years. And the reason for that was is because there's a statute of repose that keeps...
Repose, what is it for the...
Well,
count, for
if a product is over like 15 years old, you can't take them to court for a civil action because the product has been around for that long, and supposedly there's a public policy that says if it's an old product, then it, you know, there's a number of reasons. It's tort reform, okay? That's what it is. It's tort reform. You can't sue them. So the bottom line is that the only regulation that we have against gun manufacturers is a jury trial. And in this case, when you look at this, there's been reports. I think the Truth About Guns, which is a pro-gun blog, said that no other industry could survive with a failure rate like this, when they're talking about there being a 40% of all new guns contain some type of defect. I mean, I find that appalling, that 40% of new guns, some type of defect. So it is a, you know, buyer beware kind of situation.
But that's why you go to somebody like Matt, and you can go to him. I got a new pistol in, and I took it over to Matt, had him take it apart, look at it, right, put it back together, make sure everything was working right before I even fired one round.
There you go.
And so, I mean, you can always go that route. I think it's a good for your safety. If not, something happens, and you need to call me or Rick.
We hope not. Yeah. And of course, Remington says, you know, keep the barrel pointed away from other people.
Correct.
You know, that's important. But whenever you're dealing with a product that depends on human factors for safety, then you can get in trouble.
Because the humans themselves are flawed.
That's right. And you know, we're not always dealing with adults here. The Remington 700 actually sent one kid, who I believe was 17 years old at the time that he held up a gun and shot his little brother in the head, sent him to prison. And, you know, it was one of those deals where this was sort of one of the sparks that started this this knowledge about the Remington 700 models. He spent some time in prison and finally was let out because, you know, he always said, I didn't pull the trigger. I didn't do it. I didn't pull the trigger. Of course, he didn't mean to shoot his little brother.
Wow, that gave me goosebumps. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awful. It's awful. So those awful things can happen. There's, besides going to Matt, you can also go on the internet and look up things, see if there's maybe something wrong with the gun. And for instance, here's the Charter Arms Lady 38 Special Revolver. This is one of those revolvers that has a little pink on it. You know, it's a five-shot revolver.
One.
It's a little stub nose. They call it a purse gun. And, you know, what's sad is there's a notice, a remedy to be taken, and that is you bring it back to where you bought it. I think Academy is a popular place where they sold it. But when they describe the hazard of it, it says, based on customer reports and product inspections, Academy believes that some of these Charter Arms revolvers may have a manufacturing defect that could result in unsafe conditions while operating the firearm. That gives you a lot of information, doesn't it?
No.
Well, you know, they're a little bitty short guns, and bad things can happen with a little bitty short guns, right? We know that. So Academy says, yeah, let's bring it on in. It's not always the gun. It sometimes can be the ammunition. Ammunition, of course, is explosive and supposed to explode. That's what it's designed
to
do.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Does that make a difference in your kind of case when you're dealing with a firearm case? Does it make a difference when sometimes people around that maybe got hurt should have known because it was a deadly weapon like this?
Sure. Sure. There's always someone else to blame for something like this. In the situations that I described earlier, the child, of course, could have been held responsible. But Remington had the foresight to know that things weren't going to shape up with them real well in court, and we were able to get the case resolved very favorably for the fellow who was shot in the arm, who had come to me with a question about some policy that was worth a whole lot less than ultimately we were able to recover. So, yeah, it's always something having to do with. In fact, when you talk about that, like in Texas, we can't sue sugar and we can't sue tobacco because our legislature has put in the Texas Civil Code of practice that it's obvious that those are dangerous. And, you know, I've often wondered if I had a case involving lung cancer that a fellow got hooked on cigarettes while he was a teenager back in the early 60s, whether I could still take that case in Texas. I'm being told by other trial lawyers, no, you can't. But in my belief, you can, because it wasn't well known that tobacco was dangerous back in the early 60s.
And you had fraud being perpetrated by several of the major companies in the industry through expert fraud reports. You had a reason to believe otherwise.
Yeah, but you have great lawyers out there that say, yeah, no, the Texas Code of Civil Practice says, nope, can't go after tobacco, even though there was fraud and even though there was this element of someone being addicted to the tobacco before the general knowledge came along. And, you know, it's true. A lot of these folks, they finally do stop smoking. And that, again, is something that's permanently inscribed on a piece of stone, the date that they stop smoking. So they do smoke beyond the date that they should have stopped. A lot of people are able to stop. So juries, again, can apply that thing we talked about, the personal responsibility, to the person who smoked and continued to smoke. But still, the tobacco companies were bad and really should deserve some of the responsibility and accountability here.
But if you've already started and you've been going in it 10 years and the addictive principles of it makes it just hard to just quit. Some people may not have that willpower. I think to completely absolve them of any responsibility when they were intentionally, knowingly putting out the addictive principles, I think that started the whole process. You're right. It's a good case.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate you coming, Ross. Tell us one more time how we can contact you.
105 East Main Street here in Cameron. Big Milk Cow on the side. Can't miss it. 605-254-605-4140. That's 254-605-4140. Or email me. Email me all day long about the show. We love questions. I tell you, I get several emails a week. Don't be afraid to email me. It's Benton@Watson.legal. That's Benton@Watson.legal.
All right. And you can contact me, Richard Dodd, over at Capolino Dodd Krebs. We do a lot of death cases. We do a lot of products cases and asbestos. Now we're working on the earplugs that were made by 3M for servicemen between 2003 and 2015. Men and women, I'm sorry. And we will be back, so you guys hold on. We'll have a devotional, and we'll have a little bit of information from Matt about a product, and then we'll talk to Sarah Bogan about yoga. What you need to, you know I got it too. All I'm asking you is for a little respect when you come home. Just a little bit, hey, baby, just a little bit. Hello, just a little bit, mister, just a little bit. I ain't gonna do you wrong. Hi, I'm Jason Donalock from EBCO Development. What happens when that bargain roofing job fails? Your roof leaks and your ceiling is damaged. You pay for it. That's what. Especially when your bargain roofer is uninsured. Good idea? No. So why take chances? EBCO Development has been there for you since 1984. New construction, roofing, remodeling, siding, and more. Call us first. 254-697-2186. 697-2186.
Capolino Dodd Krebs Law Firm focuses on cases involving asbestos exposure, mesothelioma, birth trauma, defective products, and injury and death resulting from car and truck wrecks. Call the tough, experienced injury attorneys at Capolino Dodd Krebs Law Firm in Cameron. Call 888-MESO-FIRM or 254-697-4965.
Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures. If you've decided to carry a handgun for self-defense, you better know what you're doing. If you don't, you better learn fast. Not only fast, but thoroughly. Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures fills the void between a Johnny wannabe and a person who has been properly trained in the proper handling and use of a firearm. Call me, Matt Beatros, at 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com and set up a class or seminar to get you started on the road to proficiency with a firearm for self-defense. Go to our website, aaronsgunshop.com, and review the High Cap Adventures page. We have seminars to cover most forms of firearms training. Call 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com to get more information on how to get started with your training. The time for games is over. Reality starts now. AaronsGunshop.com.
Josh Koontz, the owner of ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer, Texas, is an avid gun enthusiast and enjoys helping all of his customers to find the gun that's perfect for them. With a large selection of pistols, rifles, and shotguns, finding the right gun becomes easy. Go to ANC Firearms, located at 5819 U.S. Highway 190 in Heidenhammer, or call them 254-983-4417. Pistols, rifles, shotguns, ammo, knives, and a whole lot more. ANC Firearms, 254-983-4417.
Okay, now I'm going to go right into our next spotlight, and that's ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer. We've got the 1911, American Tactical 1911. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you were to go look at my YouTube channel and my Facebook page, you would get to see the video I have of the 1911 9mm American Tactical pistol. I'm shooting it. You can just see how lovely it looks when it fires, okay? And I'm going to be talking about that. It's the American Tactical 1911 and 9mm at ANC Firearms. Arch Koontz is the owner. Check him out. Great guy. Great staff. Clint, Mike, and Dennis. They got pistol, rifles, shotguns, ammo, knives, accessories, the works. But in particular, they can get you this 1911 right here. However, I have modified it a little bit, of course. It's not the way you would get it out of the box. But first thing we're going to do, a collective shout out there as to what do we do when we get a firearm. We're going to check it to make sure it's not loaded, right? I'm going to drop the magazine. Magazine is clear. Slide to the rear. Chamber is clear. And magazine well is clear. This weapon is clear. Now, we're looking at it right here. It's a beautiful gun. I added on the muzzle brake, which generally reduces muzzle flip by about 30%. I put my Pierce grip finger grooves in there for better grip on the weapon. And if you can see those grips, I happened to see those at a gun show one day, and I said, man, that would look good on this gun. So I put it on there. You basically get a mahogany grip. Let me read to you a quick review. This is from the Modern Rifleman. I dissected the article for time's sake, and I'm going to read to you the pertinent information that applies to this firearm that you can get through ANC Firearms. This is from the Modern Rifleman. About the firearm. John Moses Browning's 1911 is without a doubt the most timeless semi-automatic handgun ever to be conceived. The summation of Browning's previous work in a handgun development during the late 1890s and early 1900s, the 1911 was revolutionary both in terms of operation and power of a firearm. After Colt's submission proved reliable in 1910 testing, the U.S. Army adopted the pistol in April of 1911, thus dubbing it the model of 1911 or M1911 for short. Following World War II, Filipino forces took possession of several thousand U.S.-produced examples and adopted the handgun as the standard military sidearm. As a result of the 1911's wide adoption and incredible popularity among Filipino forces and civilian shooters, several companies in the Philippines have made a living off producing faithful copies of the classic American pistol. One such company is Shooter Arms Manufacturing in Quezon City. Respected for closely adhering to original specifications, SAM, as I abbreviated, produces a wide variety of 1911s geared toward all sorts of shooters. While SAM has sold 1911s in the United States under the name for several years, ATI has recently started distributing SAM 1911s under the Firepower Extreme, or FX, brand. This example is one such model, dubbed as the ATI FX Military 1911. It represents a near-exact clone of the classic 5-inch barrel. Now, I've got the 4-inch commander size. ATI makes them all. They got the officer model, commander model, and government model. Operationally, the 1911 is a classic. The ATI FX is certainly not a departure from the John Browning's timeless design, timeless cam action design. As is the case with many standard 1911s, the FX 1911 uses a half-length steel guide rod for the recoil spring. The trigger of the FX 1911 is a standard medium-length 1911 trigger. This means the length of pull is slightly longer than the government 1911 A1 and slightly shorter than most government 1911s. The pull and reset are both very short at around 1 to 2 millimeters each, and the pull weight hovers in about 5-pound area. Internally, the pistol makes up use of the old Series 70 style layout as made famous by the Colt 1911s. From the finish perspective, the FX 1911 is actually fairly impressive. The parkerization that covers all metal surfaces, save the barrel, is very evenly done and is a very dark gray in color. The grip panels on the ATI are made of mahogany and have been checkered in a manner similar to the grips of World War II issued 1911s. The manual thumb safety on the ATI has similar contours to what is typically present on issued examples. The grip safety is a standard 1911 A1 lever. Though the safety is not beaver-tailed, as it is popular today, I did not suffer any hammer bite while testing the firearm at the range. The ATI is packaged with a single 8-round blued steel magazine manufactured by ACT in Italy. Now, ACT magazine, ladies and gentlemen, are very good. I have a lot of those. Unlike the 7-round World War I, World War II issue magazine, the ACT magazines feature a base plate that extends approximately a half inch from the bottom of the magazine. And also, this is me talking, the ACT magazine have stainless steel followers as compared to plastic or just cheap stamped followers, which makes it very reliable. The trigger is surprisingly good. As a single-action gun, the 1911 trigger features only one pull weight and distance for shooters to learn. I would place my example at around 4.5 to 5 pounds of resistance with a minuscule 1 millimeter of take-up before the hammer falls. Reset is also tiny, around 1 millimeter. Overall, the trigger makes for a very repeatable shooter. Now, for those of us who only seek a solid 1911 for the range and even self-defense, the FX will fit the bill admirably, even if higher capacity and lighter options exist in the 45 ACP. As far as affordable 1911s go, the ATI military most closely replicates the look and feel of the classic 1911 A1 and will be an excellent option for curious shooters who respect its heritage or seasoned collectors who are looking to spare their collectible 1911s for unnecessary wear. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that was just a brief article, but I'm telling you, I'm a 1911 guy. I eat, sleep, drink 1911s. I shoot them extremely well. And one of the main reasons is because the trigger is great. You can't beat a 1911 trigger. Now, it's a little old school when it comes to the functioning of it, as compared to like a Glock. You load it, pull the trigger, bang, bang, bang. This one, you got to get it going in operation. But with practice, you can get this thing going just as quick as a Glock, okay? Now, the ATI, you can go to AaronsGunShop.com, go to the Facebook page, take a look at me shooting this weapon, and then call ANC Firearms in Heidenheim at 983. That's 254-983-4417. Tell them you heard it here on the radio. Have them order yours or pick the one up on the shelf that they've got there. If they've already sold it, they can order you another one. It's an excellent gun for an excellent price. I highly recommend it. Check it out. ANC Firearms in Heidenheim. Luke, let's take a break.
Capolino Dodd Krebs Law Firm in Cameron prides themselves on service, resourcefulness, knowledge of the law, and attention to detail. So if you or a loved one has been injured by someone else's negligence, they can help. Call 888-637-6347 for help today from Capolino Dodd Krebs Law Firm. Capolino Dodd Krebs Law Firm will work as hard for your family as you do. Call 800-460-0606 for Capolino Dodd Krebs.
All right, yeah, the 1911, that's got a sweet trigger on it. Now, that 700 Remington that you might own, I have a couple of them. You can go on the website and see whether or not yours is one of the newer models that doesn't have the defect or whether the defect has been cured. You can send it back to Remington and get it cured if it's not. For instance, one of the things you can look at is right in front of the trigger on the plate, there will be a divot put in by a punch. If it's cured or if it was born cured. Today we have with us Sarah Bogan, yoga instructor.
Hi.
Teaching here in Cameron. Sarah, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into yoga in the first place?
I started practicing yoga pretty much by myself when I was 13. I saw someone doing it, and I grew up in Mississippi and never had seen it before, and just something about it appealed to me. And I got a book and started practicing by myself. I finally got my first teacher when I was 19.
So now you teach?
I do.
Have you always wanted to be a teacher?
I didn't always want to be a teacher, but at some point my teacher asked me to teach for them, and I began teaching that way. And it comes a point where you just need to teach what you know.
So is there a certification that's needed to be an instructor?
When I started teaching, there wasn't. That's kind of a relatively new thing within the last, considering how old yoga is, last 15 years, certification has become more important. But I have gotten certified since
okay.
Then.
So with regard to yoga, what are some of the things that would call you to be certified? In other words, what is it that you have to learn to be certified?
The program that I went through was about a year long, and they taught several different kinds of yoga, and they taught about health benefits of yoga, fitness, the philosophies, different kinds of philosophies, and mostly just communicating with your students, seeing what your students need and being able to give them that.
So you you got the certification. Yes. About yoga, so you learned these different aspects of it. Now, I realize that yoga may not be a martial art, but what is it about yoga that might be a tool or might be important with regard to our self-defense?
I think that teaching yoga, practicing yoga, helps you be more in the moment, which is we're often worrying about the past, we're worrying about the future, we're always thinking about something now, where we have to be next. And practicing yoga can slow that process down. So say, for the example, you do find yourself in a situation that's questionable. Say, for example, a bad guy comes up and wants something. Possibly by staying calm and staying in the moment, you may be able to react in a way that doesn't lead to violence, or maybe you can get out of it a little more easily. Sometimes that doesn't always work that way. And hopefully through that, the practicing of yoga can help you recover from that trauma.
So have you ever worked with groups of people that have experienced some sort of trauma?
I have.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I worked for 5 years at Laurel Ridge Treatment Center, teaching soldiers who had post-traumatic stress and issues related to that, often alcohol abuse or drug abuse.
How did yoga help them?
A lot of them told me that they felt more relaxed. They had a lot of trouble sleeping. Your mind went running. And yoga takes you back to your breath. It's synchronizing movement with breath, working with balance. When you're balancing, all you have to think about at this moment is standing on one foot. You don't have to think about what you have to do tomorrow or what happened 3 months ago. You're just standing on one foot. And that seems very simple, but it's kind of powerful if you can just give yourself that little break. I had some that were regular. They wanted to come back all the time. Some did not want to participate as much. But I would always invite them to stay in the room, to still be a part of it, to still be included, even when they didn't feel like they wanted to be included. And I have to say, I think I got the best out of them. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Was this sponsored by the military?
Not by the military. It was a private company, but only active duty soldiers were admitted. It was a come and go clinic, day clinic.
Okay. So it was semi-military then.
It was only soldiers.
Okay.
They were referred from Fort Hood.
Okay. So, Sarah, tell us, what do you do now? Where do you teach now?
I teach in Belton. I teach a class for people who have Parkinson's. I've been doing that for about 7 years. We meet once a week. That class is seated. Some standing for those who wish to stand. We work mostly on balance and mobility.
Because these folks have movement disorders then.
They do. Which also affects the voice, so we do a little singing too.
Okay.
Yes. And I have a class here in Cameron, and I have a class in Temple.
Where and when?
The class in Cameron is at the Episcopal Church, which is 200 North Travis Avenue, and that class is on Tuesdays at 12:30 to 1:30. The other class in Temple is at the Cultural Activity Center at 3011 North 3rd Street in Temple, Texas. That's Monday nights at 5:15 to 6:30. And the Parkinson Support Group is at the Foundations Methodist Church at 10751 West Adams Avenue And that address is Temple. It's got Temple, Belton, kind of Mark Place. And if you're anyone's interested in the Parkinson group, please email me at sarah@wolfmoonyoga.com, and I can contact you to the person that can set you up, because that support group is not just yoga. They also give information workshops. They have symposiums. They do a lot of information. So
what about Alzheimer's? Are there any students that suffer from that?
This is just Parkinson's.
Okay. Yeah. So someone who has, a movement disorder caused by another disease wouldn't benefit from that, or it's a different group?
They would, but this group is just for people that have Parkinson's, because it's a part of the Palmer movement disorder
okay.
group. So it's a separate group, but I would say that any...
So if someone goes on wolfmoonyoga.com, will there be a little place there where they can put their information in and contact you that
absolutely,
way?
Absolutely. And I can hook them up with the people they need to talk to get part of this group or any other group.
So every Monday evening at 5:15 at the CAC, that's the Cultural Arts Center?
That is.
Okay. And then the Episcopal Church, for all of old folks here in Cameron, that used to be Anderley Lumber, I believe.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That was more than 2 months ago, anyway. So, I appreciate you coming on. You got anything else to add, talk about?
No, thank you.
I know there's different kinds of yoga. I've heard of Baptiste yoga. I've heard of Hatha and Ashtanga and a bunch of others. Is there a big difference?
There is a difference.
Hot yoga.
The postures are the same. Hot yoga, you pretty much just turn the temperature up and, work really hard. I practice Ashtanga yoga, and there are six different series. It starts with primary series, and you have to work your way through primary series, and then you get to second series. And that one appeals to me a lot more. It's very precise, and there's numbers, there's counts to every, and I was a former ballet dancer, so I love nothing more than form and technique. So that one appealed to me. What I like about it is I can take anything from Ashtanga and apply it to teaching someone in a wheelchair.
Okay.
Take the same principles of that, the same working efficiently, working intelligently with your body to do what you can do at that moment wherever you are.
So sometimes I come out of the courthouse, and a lot of courthouses in America are not in what you would call the best part of town. And, of course, guess what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about what the judge said or one of my witnesses said. I'm not thinking about the fellow lurking over in the dark corner in the parking garage. So this mindfulness you speak of, is that sort of how we relate to self-defense here and just making sure you don't get in trouble in the first place?
Yes, the self-defense being in avoiding the conflict and avoiding the conflict by being aware of your surrounding. And yoga kind of can give you that moment of being practicing, because that takes practice, because you're right, we always are going on to the next thing, and it takes practice to sit down and just sit here in the moment, listen to the sounds of the room. So you walk out the door and you take a scan of the place. As a woman, I think we all kind of do that. Who is closest to me in the parking lot? Who's walking to their car? What car is coming by as I'm walking toward my car? That kind of awareness, as opposed to checking your phone and worrying about, oh, did I get everything?
Well, I know there's a lot of people out there that keep thinking about some sort of a program where they help themselves be able to touch their toes and maybe be able to move out the door a little faster or move away from a criminal a little faster. And I know a lot of people say, well, I could, I should, I must. And then they go back to they could now, mm-hmm. right? Because you teach here in Cameron.
That's right. Yes.
So is there any reason for someone who, I guess is built a little bit less than Arnold Schwarzenegger was 20 years ago, to be afraid to come to your class?
There's no reason to be afraid to come to the class. And touching your toes is highly overrated. So you don't have to know how to do that. You don't have to know how to do anything. Just show up. You'll have to take your shoes off.
That's
it. Barefoot. Bring a mat. If you don't have a mat, call me. I'll throw one in the back seat.
All right. Well, that is, again, wolfmoonyoga.com.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you.
That particular week. So here we go now. I'm going to read to you one I sent out on Tuesday, and it goes as follows. Good morning. The younger is taught by the elder. From sunrise to sunset, in many different ways and forms, it is to us, the older, who teaches the younger to love the Lord with all we have in us. Okay? This comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, 4 through 9. It reads as follows. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart.
God bless and keep your powder dry.